It's the Criterion. It's the Criterion. 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 And Crudgent.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Criterion Project. And we are excited today to be here to be talking about Richard Linklater's magnum opus, the movie that took 12 years to film. As everybody knows, we're talking about Boyhood today on the Criterion Project. Very excited about that. And I'm film critic Rachel Wagner. Conrado is here.
Yes, he is. How's it going, yes. Rachel?
And we have a very special guest with us today to talk about this film. Trevor Wallace is here. Trevor, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I've been a fan as a friend of Conrado's for a while and listened to a lot of it. And I'm just really excited to talk about a movie on a podcast. It's a first time for me.
Oh, yeah.
Very exciting. We should say Trevor is not just my friend, although he's a very dear friend. He is also a filmmaker in his own right. He is Idaho's favorite son, and he is an all-around great person. So I'm really excited that you're here, Trevor.
Thank you. Yes, we've got a big movie in the works right now that, pandemic aside, we'd have more to share on, but it's coming along. Conrado actually is one of the stars in that movie. So all sorts of helping each other out across different mediums here, which is what we like to do as friends.
That's cool. How did you two meet?
The director of the film and a couple films I've worked on with him before, A.B. Seidel, is new Conrado through college, I believe, right, Conrado?
Yeah, that's right.
And so we kind of became mutual friends through him, and now have worked together, and now we're podcasting together, and that's what friendship is these days, right?
Pretty much.
Definitely. Yeah. You're not my friend if you haven't had me on your podcast, everyone listening.
Yeah, they just had a Lifetime movie about a podcaster.
On
Lifetime.
That's how you know it's become mainstream. If grandparents watching Lifetime or getting podcaster stories.
And one of the first things she says is, "Haven't you listened to my podcast?" And I was like, "That's accurate. That is very, very correct."
Yeah, that's true. How I preface or how I start every conversation nowadays. Have you listened to my podcast? Have you watched my web series, Wormholes, which is available on YouTube, and the season finale comes out next Wednesday?
Which people should watch. They just did a musical episode. They're pulling out all the stops on this show. Yeah, y'all should watch this show.
Thanks, friend.
So let's talk a little bit about what we've been watching there on the Criterion channel or Criterion, like soon to be someday on the Criterion channel. Conrado, have you been able to watch anything?
Yeah, I actually watched a movie that was a coincidence, but it ended up being a really great pairing with Boyhood. It's a movie that I've been wanting to see for a long time. It's called Yi Yi, and it's a Taiwanese movie by director, Edward Yang. From 2000, and it's basically follows a family in Taiwan for about a year, just the things that they have to deal with. But what I thought was very interesting is that the original idea for the movie that Edward Yang had was to make a movie following a person from their birth to their death. So, you know, not so different from kind of the Boyhood idea. But of course, you know, he didn't have 12 years to make it. So what he did was that instead he made it about a family so he could focus on different moments of life through different people in the family, you know? Mm-hmm. So you have kind of like a young daughter who is finding her first love. And then you have a dad who is kind of like, is visited from by a lover from his past. And so he's reliving his first love. And then you have a grandma, and then you have a little kid who, by the way, the little kid, his name in the movie is Yang Yang. He is one of the best kids in any movie I've ever seen. He is my hero. He is so good. He is so funny, and he is so weirdly profound when he needs to be. It's a really beautiful movie about, you know, life and family and all that stuff. And it has been appropriately called one of the best movies of the 2000s, and I really recommend it. It's on Criterion right now, so you guys can check it out.
Oh, that sounds really good.
That's one I've heard the name of many times, so definitely we'll check it out. Yeah.
What about you, Trevor? What have you been watching?
So I was gonna try to pull my film school, film student cred, and like scroll way back into the depths of Criterion and pull some old black and white thing that I think I should champion. And then I started scrolling. I sorted them by release date to get to Boyhood because I knew it would be recent. And then I started scrolling and I hit a movie that I'd seen a couple years ago, came out in 2017, called Princess Cid, which I think Conrado is also a fan of, if I remember right.
Yeah, baby.
And I was like, oh my gosh, I get to hype up a very under-discussed movie on the podcast. So I'm picking it even though it's only a couple years old. Princess Cid is a movie about a young girl who is in high school and she's had some family trauma, rough family life, and visits her aunt in Chicago. And her aunt is a poet and a novelist and a, you know, intellectual academic, and she bonds with her aunt. She flirts with guys and girls. She gets into a thing with an androgynous barista. There's a party where people kind of flirt by reading literature, and it's just a kind of a hangout movie that the drama creeps up on you. It's not overly dramatic or intense. It's very gentle and emotion focused and really centers on three incredible performances, I think, from the three women. The main hold on, my IMDb was up and I was ready for this. The Cid is played by Jesse Pinnock, and the aunt, who I think is really phenomenal, is played by Rebecca Spence. She gives a really amazing performance as someone who's in the middle of their life processing kind of what's to come and what's past. Interacting with this very young person who's trying everything for the first time. It's just a beautiful hangout movie. It has some incredible performances. And it's what I was telling my partner, what I call gentle horny, where it's like a pretty horny movie, but in a really soft, gentle, sweet way where they talk about it a lot. And it's more about the intellectual side of it. I think it's really something special and puts you in a great mood.
I love that. What did you say? Soft horny?
Gentle horny.
Gentle horny. Love it. I'm going to apply it to, I'm going to add it to my vocabulary from now on. I agree 100% with everything you said, Trevor. I have talked about this movie. I think I mentioned it multiple times on this podcast and on Rachel's other podcast too. and I love it. And I think it's also a really great pairing with Boyhood as a coming of age story. And, you're talking about the aunt, Rebecca Spence, that moment when she has that monologue in the kitchen about her life and you know, it's just one of the great, great moments of acting I've ever seen. So good.
She kind of, the Cid kind of confronts her about sex at her age, and sex is such a big part of her young life, and she gets this moment to kind of speak on it in a way I've never heard anyone speak about sex, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I've never heard it put quite that way. And I agree, that moment is phenomenal. So yeah, it's just one that really creeps up on you. It's not, we're going to get into pretentiousness scale, but I'd say it's pretty unpretentious. It's pretty chill. And I think that makes it really accessible. So I hope people seek it out.
Yeah, I've heard that from Conrado. So I better watch it one of these days. So what I picked, I have a weird thing going on right now where I'm watching a lot of Hallmark movies and Christmas movies, and yet then I also have the four-year consideration screeners to watch at the same time, so I'm very whipped back and forth between highbrow and I don't know if you'd call Hallmark a lowbrow, but whatever.
Hallmark isn't getting any Oscars this year, is that what you're saying?
Right. but one of the ones that I watched, it's not on the Criterion channel, but it will be someday, is called Minari. And I thought of it because it has some of the same feel of Boyhood. It's a little bit of a slow burn about this Korean immigrant family. And they are in, they moved to Arkansas to start a farm. And the father, he doesn't realize that this land has been tried a number of times and failed. And but he puts everything into trying to make this farm a a success. Steven Yeun is so good as the dad, and the little boy, I mean, is the cutest thing to ever exist, and he's so cute, and it's really a powerful film about the American dream, and is it an illusion? And it's also has, even though it can be quite devastating, it also has hope in it, and I thought it was really beautiful. And I think if people can kind of tolerate the pacing, then I think they'll really, really enjoy it.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about this movie. So, and I have a question. Rachel, you watched it on a screener, I assume, right?
Yeah, they did on Sunday, this last Sunday, they did a virtual screening.
Yeah, and do you know where people will be able to see it, if it's going to be available? Because I know it's going to be pushed for Oscars, and it was at Sundance, but I haven't heard about any like release.
Let me see. It's A24. Let's see if they say anything.
Also heard a lot of good things about it. It's very anticipated for me. Glad to hear you both recommending movies with good kids in them. I love a kid in a movie.
I know, and we all have this like thematic resonance with Boyhood, so I'm digging that too. We can make like a whole like film festival, like coming of age
special, contemplative coming of age. Yeah, exactly. Movies. Yeah.
On the A24 website, it says release date February 12th, 2021. So it sounds like they're going to try a theatrical release. Yeah, I don't know if it'll be same day VOD or if they'll do a short.
Well, we'll see, because everything is up in the air right now with like the HBO Max thing and everything, so we'll see what happens with releases next year. But definitely sounds like something they're gonna want to push for Oscars, since the eligibility window has changed this year. So February seems like it's the new December for this Oscar season.
Yeah, I mean, I would be really surprised if Steven Yeun doesn't at the very least get nominated. But, you know,
we'll see. I hope so. He deserves it. He's been knocking it out of the park lately.
All right. Well, let's dive into Boyhood. I thought it might be interesting just to talk about our initial feelings about it, and then compare it maybe how they were different or the same during this rewatch. And so when I saw this in 2014, I knew nothing about it. And what back in the old days, I used to go to the indie theater here, the Art House Theater in Salt Lake, and would just go the whole day and watch the movies the whole day.
You're gonna make me cry, Rachel. I miss that so much. That's beautiful.
It was a different time. I found some amazing films doing that. There were, of course, a lot of clunkers, but I saw some incredible films, and that's what basically happened to me with Boyhood. And I knew that it was Richard Linklater, so that made me excited because I love him, and I love the Before movies, so that alone had me intrigued. But I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know that it was 12 years in the making. I didn't know. It was very early on, so I was lucky. And I go in, and I was just blown away. I felt like, oh, that was really special. That was a really special experience. And then it was kind of hard. I felt like when I kind of wished that it hadn't been in the Oscar race, because I just felt like it was such a special experience, and then it was just kind of throw your pearls before swine. You know, these people that can't appreciate this, I was like, this is not a movie for the average person going to Transformers movies or going to, you know, your blockbuster movies. This is for somebody who has, I think, a little bit more sophistication as a film goer, not to be too snobby, but I don't know, it was just like, it was so special, and then it had to get raked through the coals by these Oscar people. And so then I rewatched, I actually hadn't seen it again since then, and I found myself almost liking it in a new way, because all these small moments that it captures, I've been missing for this year, and small moments of humanity with other people, because I've been isolated mostly by myself, and so I don't know. I would love to have some of those like moments of human connection that they have, and you do through the podcast and other things, but it's just not quite the same as some of these moments that you see in here. So it was a great experience both times for me. But Conrado, what about you? What was your experience with this film?
I think it was pretty similar. I remember seeing it back in 2014. It definitely had, I knew about the buzz around it back when I saw it, but it came out in the summer, so it was before the thick of Oscar season. And I enjoyed it quite a bit. I thought it was really good. And I think similarly since then, with all the Oscar stuff and then many years of people saying, oh, it's overrated, it's not as good, like whatever, I had kind of, I don't know, I had the feeling that if I saw it again, I would probably be kind of mixed about it. And now seeing it for the second time ever, I actually, I'd say I still have a couple things here and there that I don't absolutely love about the movie, but I thought it was really effective in a lot of ways, and that it held up pretty well. So I was glad to revisit it, because I don't know if I would have done that otherwise. It seems like a movie that it's both celebrated by a lot of people and you know, in a lot of lists of the best movies or whatever, and also pushed down by a lot of other people because it was so... I guess it was weirdly like divisive and controversial in its time. And I think it was mostly, like you're saying, because it was kind of inflated and anointed as this super achievement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you, Trevor?
I, similarly to y'all, watched it when it came out, and this is my first time since. So that's exciting. We all kind of are in the same perspective there.
Yeah.
I also remember liking it a lot when it came out. That was toward the very end of my college days, so I was in a reflective mood at that time. And so it was a perfect audience for it. And I honestly was a little anxious to talk to y'all about it, because I also felt I was a perfect audience because I'm also a like lower middle class straight white guy that remembers driving and listening to music and reflecting on life. And so many of these experiences felt like directly aimed at me in terms of who this person is. He's a bit of an introvert like me, has a more artistic, outgoing sister like me. And I just felt as I went to revisit it, that I'm like, did I love this movie so much because it really felt like a reflection on my kind of life? And does it work for someone who hasn't lived this kind of life? So I'm excited that y'all were positive on it and felt it still worked. I'm interested to get into kind of how much of that comes from relatability for both of y'all, and what parts of it worked because of relatability for me, and what parts I think kind of stand above that. On the rewatch, I was surprised at, from being... it's been 6 years or so since I've seen it, how many scenes I remembered pretty much verbatim in terms of what happened and the kind of moments and speeches he got from these different people. I was kind of, for a movie that doesn't necessarily have a plot in a traditional sense, where things are, one scene affects the next directly, I didn't remember the order of scenes, but I remembered so many of the moments and beats. And I think that speaks to how they capture a truth to them in what's happening, and hopefully capture a truth in what people are saying and the kinds of ways people are engaging life.
Mm-hmm. I want to co-sign that, because I it's not exactly that I remember them, but more so that when the scene started in this rewatch, I was like, oh yeah, this scene, I do remember this scene, and I know what they're going to say, and I agree or I don't agree or whatever with what they're going to say, but definitely it had made an impact on me that I wasn't fully aware of. So that's another thing that I think made me really glad and excited while rewatching. I also want to say, if I can, I want to take a guess and say that the scene in this movie that best represents young Trevor Wallace's experience is the one where Mason is going camping with his dad and by the fire, and he's like, do you think they will ever make another Star Wars? I feel like that's every weekend of young Trevor's life.
So when I... Yes, you're right, in both the camping and the dad and the Star Wars of it all. I remember when that scene came up, and he was like, oh, you know, if they ever make a movie, this game is like the period where they should do it. And I remember, like, I know what game he's talking about. I agree with him. That's the correct answer. I was like, I know exactly what he's talking about. And then I remember there was a behind-the-scenes interview where they, like, explained what it was. And I was like, yep, I was right about that. So, Conrado, you know me well enough to nail that on the head. yeah, I think, gosh, I just want to, there's so many, in talking about this movie, we have so much detail to get through, and there's so many things that we could discuss, but the pop culture is an interesting one on how many times you just see a screen and the way the TV or the device that he's watching on changes and the content changes. And I was like, yep, this kid had my pop culture upbringing pretty much.
One of the things that really stood out to me when I first saw it is was particularly more the mother character, Patricia Arquette character, versus the Mason character, because I think her character, it's interesting because she makes so many poor choices, and as far as certainly her husband's, And I kind of feel like, so you have Ethan Hawke's character, who is able, the first 2 years he's gone and he's in Alaska. He's had this traumatic breakup of his family, and he gets to go to Alaska to sort of reset his life, and how that makes all the difference between the choices that I think that then he goes on to make. And I kind of feel like maybe that's something the movie is trying to say, that this mother, this woman, she never gets a reset. She never gets a chance to evaluate her life, because she's just going. And she kind of makes the choices that are available to her to make. And that if she had had a moment she'd had more support, she'd had somebody there to help her so that she could have a moment to really kind of think about what she's doing as opposed to just making the choices available, how that makes such a difference. But as a mom, you don't have that luxury. You have to, you know, provide for your family, your children. You don't have a moment to kind of reset and decide what you want in life. You just live. Mm-hmm. And so that was something I think that's pretty powerful in the movie.
I totally agree. I was really struck by how, a lot of the hype goes into you watch the kids grow up over 12 years. But I was really struck by how beautiful it was to watch the adults grow up over 12 years. And I think Patricia Arquette benefits the most from that. You see her body changes, her face changes. She's going through life in the real world, and it comes through in the character. And I think it really speaks to how much it contrasts with the Ethan Hawke character. At the beginning, he's the deadbeat, classic divorced dad buying his kids presents and lying to his ex-wife and all the tropes of that character. And he's become much more interesting and complicated by the end. And there's really great scenes of them right at the end of the movie that I think really highlight what you're saying, Rachel, that he's kind of gotten himself to a new place in life that feels, at least to me, more healthy. And she's not really been able to grow in that same way. She's just kind of survived while she got the kids out the door. And I think it's very much the movie's asking you, especially with her last scene, oh my gosh, to reckon with that and to reckon with the fact that of all the characters in this movie, she's been given the least help and the least chances. So many times she talks to her kids directly about, like, I need stuff from me. You guys don't get it. And I don't think they ever truly understand it. Which is just natural. They're young and you can't, you know? So, yeah, she was, I think, the only person to win an Oscar for this movie in terms of performances, and mm-hmm. certainly deserved, because I think her character really shines through, especially on this rewatch for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely deserved.
Go ahead,
Sam. And should I go? I wanted to say I'm glad that both of you mentioned this. I think what you're saying is really interesting and valuable, because one of the questions that I had on this rewatch is that one of the things that didn't make as much of an impression on me the first time around, but much more this time, was the Ethan Hawke character and Ethan mm-hmm. Hawke's performance and that transformation and how it compares to Patricia Arquette's. And I had that question of, like, after watching it and enjoying the movie a lot and being moved, I did have this thing rattling inside me saying, like, you know, that guy, he got to change and he got to better his life. And he seems to be in a pretty good place by the end. And he has a pretty much positive transformation pretty clearly throughout. Whereas Patricia Arquette, the movie, you know, she keeps marrying these people who are horrible, and she keeps, like, you know, struggling, and she has to figure all these things out. And I was feeling like the movie was being a little bit, you know, ungenerous to her. But I feel like after hearing what you guys have to say, it feels like it's kind of the point. And mm-hmm. And I think it's also very truthful, you know?
I think there's something too, there's something very pointed by the fact that her last scene is a very sad one, and perhaps one of the saddest in the movie, in terms of it ends on her reflecting on life in a very negative way, and in a kind of just mm-hmm. desperate and sad way that feels like one of, it's definitely, you know, it's a standout from the movie because it's a big acting moment, but I think it's also part of the movie's thesis in a way. And I think giving that to her at the end, it makes her sort of a tragic character as she's looking back on her life. And you have to, I think, reckon with that. Like, oh yeah, mm-hmm. I was being a little hard on her, as Mason was. He says, you know, parade of drunken assholes is how he refers to his father-in-laws at one point, the series of them that happened in the movie. And I think he judges her pretty harshly for it. And it's kind of maybe that last moment with her is the first time, as he's about to leave for college, that he's forced to confront his mom as a person. And maybe he'll grow to respect her a little more growing up. I certainly mm-hmm. hope she gets more chances in the future here.
Yeah, when she says, "This is the worst day of my life,"
yeah,
at the end, mm-hmm. it's very devastating. And you just think that all the people in your own life that sacrificed for you to be able to grow up, mm-hmm. And it's a sobering thought. And there's so many lovely moments in this film that I really bonded with, but I think one of my favorites is the whole scene with the photography instructor,
mm-hmm.
where he's just trying so hard to motivate him and to to inspire him. And you think back on all the teachers and other people in your own life who really believed in you. And it's, again, a humbling thought.
Mm-hmm. In ways, this movie kind of becomes a study on mentor figures. Mm-hmm. We spend so much of the time with Mason's parents and his step-parents and his teachers and his whoever, you know. I wondered if any, like, were there particular lessons that really kind of resonated with you all? Did any of, because some of it is meant, I think, to be felt as like, yeah, they're trying to talk to a teenage boy and he's just not picking up on this. And some of it does land. And I was curious which, the darkroom scene is certainly a standout for me too, mm-hmm. Because I can kind of, I'm just enough older that I can look back and be like, yeah, it sucks to hear this, buddy, but you have to work harder than you're working to be an artist. You know, like, I've learned that lesson in the future. So yeah, I wondered what other of the kind of lessons or mentor figures kind of clicked with y'all or resonated with y'all.
Something that it's not, I think it's not exactly an answer to the question that you're asking, mm-hmm. but I will say that something that I did hear when I was young, when I was Mason's age, when around the same time that he hears it in the movie, that definitely I took to heart, was when an adult told me that the key to, like, getting girls and having a relationship was to actually listen to them, you know? And when I first heard that as a teenager, I was like, oh, that's the secret. I'm going to do that. And definitely my whole strategy, you know, trying to find a girlfriend back then was to just like listen to what they had to say and really take mental notes and then bring it up later and be like, oh, remember when you said this? And, you know, things like that. So that, and that also sounds like something very much like a dad or a grown-up from that generation would say to a teenager.
I think he says the bar is low. Like, if you listen, you'll be ahead of most guys. And I think that's very true.
Yeah.
But I even really enjoy the whole portrayal of the salad bar manager guy who... Mm-hmm. Who maybe a little bit tough on him and things, but he's just trying to kind of motivate him. And he, you know, he feels he's very proud of his restaurant and that he manages, and he wants him to, you know, to work harder. And I feel like that's a very relatable character.
I'm very glad you mentioned that character, Rachel, because I think one of the things that I really, liked about the movie this time around is seeing that I feel like Linklater is really trying to kind of undercut what you expect from a movie perspective, you know? Like, in a movie, usually that character, the manager, would be a total wet blanket and we wouldn't like him and he would be pushing Mason for no reason, you know, and trying to exploit him or whatever. And that kind of thing kind of comes up again and again, characters being more complex or like more realistic than they would be in a movie, you know, having different sides to them. I'm thinking also of like the scene in which they're at the construction site camping overnight and they're throwing buzz saws into the wood. And in any other movie, someone would have an accident with the buzz saw, you know?
I was so worried when I first watched that scene, and I was like, oh my God, they're drinking, they're going to kill somebody, you know? And
yeah, exactly.
Then it's not that kind of movie. It's not that kind of movie.
Yeah, but it's not. And in real life, you know, we've, like, boys growing up, I know that I've done things like that. You know, I've like, thrown potatoes to each other that have, like, been bigger than you should have thrown and things like that. And it's been, you know, but nothing major has happened. And I think that's really a strength of the movie. And that, I think that's one of the things that makes it so resonant to me, that it seems right, that it doesn't seem fabricated in a Hollywood way. I would say maybe the one exception, and we can talk more about this, is the first stepdad, the drunk professor. I think Bill, that he, I think he is probably gets a little bit, I mean, I don't know. I haven't had that particular experience, so I wouldn't know, but he does seem a little bit more cartoony and less dimensional than most of the characters that we interact with. You know, he's pretty horrible towards the end, especially, and he's never really that likable to begin with, I would say.
Yeah. You do see that he starts out kind of hiding the alcohol, and then by the next year he's got it right out on the table. He's not, you know, even hiding it anymore. And when he cuts Mason's hair, that's definitely a pretty devastating moment. I would say the part that maybe rings a little false to me, at least, is the teenage relationship
mm-hmm.
he has, because to me it feels more like a college relationship than a high school relationship. And I don't know if it's just because I'm more of a traditional, I grew up more traditional experience, but I don't know, it just feels a little too mature for just the way that they're talking, the way they're acting. It feels like something more for college than for high school.
I think I chalked it up to both Mason being a very contemplative, introspective character, kind of more than, and part of that relationship is showing how he's more like that than most people his age, than she is. But also I chalked it up a little bit to, like, it's a movie made by an adult man, you know? And so sometimes it succeeds, I think, in keeping things innocent. To me, the earlier parts of the movie, when the kids are younger, I think does a is more successful in letting the kids stay silent a lot of the time and kind of letting the adults show their good and bad sides and kind of like let their hypocrisies play out. While I certainly agree with you, Conrado, that he didn't seem very nuanced, I think I really enjoyed those early, like kind of the whole Bill, that first marriage playing out, because I really enjoyed the slow ramp up of his villainy, where it starts with, you know, a bit of a mean-spirited joke at his own kids. That feels weird. Then all of a sudden we see a scene where he's yelling on the golf course and like, you know, smacks his club and takes a bit out. And it's, that's it. That's all the scene you get. But you realize like, oh, there's an anger here. And then very soon we're throwing liquor bottles at the children, you know, and it's, it happens before you even realize it. So I think in the later parts of the movie, as Mason gets older and we start doing a lot more dialogue with him, I think that you start to get that sense of like, this kid feels maybe a little too, like not quite as innocent and realistic for the age as maybe he was. Although there's people that have probably behaved like that. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think I was a pretty pretentious criterion-y teenager. I'd say I'd have conversations a little bit like that. Whether or not they're successful in the movie, I think it's a good point to make. I do agree with you, Trevor, that I think the older Mason gets and the more he becomes a central character, the movie becomes a little less effective for me. If there's any issues that I have with the movie, it's probably that it kind of, the best moments of it, for the most part, in my opinion, are in the first half of the movie when the kids are younger. And then outside of like the better moments in the latter half, I'd say, as what you guys were telling, all these moments where mentor figures kind of like get to talk and get to give the speeches, and the time that we spend with the teenagers and, you know, Mason with his girlfriend, especially, those are probably the scenes that I find the more kind of like, okay, can we move on to the next thing? This is not super interesting.
And I think that's a little surprising coming from Linklater, because he is so famous for his teenage coming of age characters in films, you know, in Dazed and Confused and Slacker.
And his long romantic conversations from the Before trilogy, you know, which they do a lot of there. Maybe it just speaks to how effective the... Maybe it's also a little bit of like, to be honest, I got to those, the teenage and kind of middle school parts of the where you groan and cringe the most because they're like being obnoxious teenagers. Yeah. And so maybe that's part of it too, is like, it's just a little less enjoyable to watch two kids that like have no idea what they're doing and aren't right for each other, like try to talk in the diner at 3 a.m. about life. You know, maybe that's just never going to be as exciting of a scene as Ethan Hawke or Patricia Arquette, you know, reflecting with their teenage son about life and growing up and everything.
Totally.
So why do we think this is a Criterion film? What makes it a Criterion worthy in your eyes, Trevor?
I did some looking through kind of their, what they say on their site, and kind of like, what do they define as it? And the word important comes up a lot, which is where I think we get into kind of the sort of quote unquote controversy behind the movie and how a lot of folks feel that the way it was made is the only noteworthy thing about it. And it's just not like, it's an interesting artifact, but is otherwise not an impressive movie. And so I guess I'll kind of say that I feel it's important as a like, I won't say completely unique. Obviously there've been other movies that do things like this, but a unique enough approach to filmmaking and is so focused on emotion and life and how we are as human beings as its primary focus, that's what makes it feel Criterion to me. But I wondered what you all felt about the important kind of part of this whole thing, because I think it's a big part of how the movie was received and then pushed back against.
I would say definitely, I would say it is pretty unique. I think you're right, Trevor, that there's been certain precedents, like, you know, the Seven documentaries or Seven Up documentaries, right? Or the, I would say like the Antoine Donnell movies by Francois Truffaut. But I feel like what this movie really benefits from and its particular approach is the fact that it's all in one movie and you have all these cuts that, like, you know, suddenly so much time has passed and the kid has actually grown and it's the same actor. And you can see there's one cut that it's very true to life in which the kid, like, grows, I don't know, like 2 inches in 1 year. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh boy, like this kid's not a kid anymore, you know? And that, I think, really is effective at really conveying that thing about time passing by that I think the movie does really well. And what I was going to say is that before this rewatch, I might have been one of those people who was like, well, you know, the conceit of the movie is really important and it's really impressive and it's really unique. I don't know if the movie is a great movie, but watching it again, I feel like it's a really solid movie. Like, you know, it's got a lot of great, memorable scenes, like we've talked about. It's got, and it's got a great, you know, it's got profound things to say. It's also got some moments that are meant to be profound that are maybe not quite as profound as the movie wants them to be. But fair enough. You know, you miss all of the shots that you don't take. And this movie takes a lot of shots and a lot of them land. And it's also very funny. And in a lot of ways, and in a very, to me, very true to life, very recognizable. Now I can't remember the term you said. Like gentle funniness is what I'm gonna say. Kind of like to harken back to the gentle horniness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it totally belongs, and it's a great movie. It's important, and it's good. And before I pass it on to Rachel, who I'm sure has a lot to say about this, I wanna just shout out. Little Samantha when she's a kid. That girl is so funny. She's killing it at the dinner table. She's like dropping her Tide Five in front of her mom and her brother while eating cereal. And the one that totally killed me is when they go out with the dad and then he's tucking her in at night and she's like, oh dad, I'm sorry. And he was like, what are you sorry about? And she's like, you know that Mason had to be there. That totally killed me. That was so funny.
She has that dry humor that's really sharp. I agree.
And that's Richard Linklater's daughter, I believe.
Yeah, who apparently hated doing the movie. She enjoyed it as a kid, but as she grew up, she was like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, Dad, can you just like kill my character or something?
Oh, man. That's funny.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it is a unique experience for fiction to see a story play out. Like we've seen it in documentaries and other things, but at least I've never seen anything quite like it for a piece of fiction. And I love it. I think it's really great. Where, as far as the pretentiousness scale that we have, the 1 being super accessible, 10 being a Jean-Luc Godard film is number 10. it's his birthday this week. Congratulations. So what do you think, Conrado?
This is an interesting question because I think this goes back to kind of the way, for me, the way the movie was received at the time and the way in which it was championed so much by critics and then it was celebrated, but also a lot of people didn't quite get it, or it seemed like, I think because it's not structured like a movie or like a, you know, mainstream entertainment kind of thing, it was, you know, it didn't land with a lot of people the way that maybe landed with the critics and some others. I also have to say that there are some, okay, now I'm going into a whole different conversation. I'm sorry. I try to make this short, but I do think that there is a kind of critique of this movie and a kind of things that you could say that the movie maybe doesn't get quite as right as some of the other stuff, a lot of the other stuff that it does, which has to do, I guess, with the perspective that the movie has on certain topics and certain issues. I was thinking about the way the female characters, but I guess that's now talking with you guys about the Patricia Arquette thing of it all. I think it feels different to me now, but I would say maybe stuff about like the scene that was talked about a lot at the time as a controversial scene is the gardener who comes back and tells the mom.
That was maybe my least favorite part of the whole thing. Cause I was like, you just, and because it was all in service of giving the mom a win as like, look, kids, the mom has gives good advice. She can be a white savior too. You know, like it was very, very cringy at that moment.
Yeah. The intention is, I understand the intention dramatically and thematically why you would want to have that moment for the mom, but it comes, you know, with this character who hasn't really been developed and it's kind of, you can tell that it's in service of this other character. So it doesn't ring quite as true. And there's, you know, and I wouldn't say there's a lot of that, but there's a little bit of it. That being said, that's not the conversation we were having. We were talking about the pretentiousness scale, but I'm struggling with this pretentiousness thing. I think I would put it somewhere in the middle. You know, I think it's accessible. I think that people can get something out of it if they can get into the movie's wavelength, but also it's not, you know, it's not your average summer movie kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd actually say I think it's pretty high on the pretentiousness scale. As much as I love it, I feel like it's definitely not for everybody. And but I'd probably give it like an 8.
What's your average? I want to know what your average on the show is. Like, you know, do you give generally high or generally low? That's
I feel like we've given a lot of like 6s and 7s. Do you agree, Kanato?
Yeah. It's been lower than you would expect a show about the Criterion Collection to be. Mm-hmm, like, I feel like we're always kind of... It's also because we... well, first of all, we don't want to watch movies that are too long because it takes up our time. So we a lot of the like really contemplative three-hour Tarkovsky we haven't seen or covered in the show yet. And also, we want to watch things that we are going to enjoy. So I think that kind of skews us always to be a little generous to the movies, be like, well, it's not as pretentious, you know, you can watch it, you'll enjoy it.
We know there's worse out there, you know, is the thing.
Yeah.
I would say the big question for me on this one, because the presentation of the movie, I think, is very unpretentious. The filmmaking is extremely straightforward and easy to follow. There's no unusual uses of editing or confusing in any way. It's very clear and easy to follow. And I think the, you know, it's kind of mundane experiences. You're not really asking the audience to push very far, except in that it's slow and there isn't a driving plot with, you know, big moments of drama necessarily. Although there are moments of drama in the movie, they don't follow in terms of build up and payoff the way you expect. So the question just becomes like, is it pretentious to ask someone to be patient in watching a movie? And it's kind of, the answer has become yes. We've become very, very impatient and very like, oh, that's a slow almost three hour movie. Well, that's an art movie that's only for, you know, people that are, you know, snobs about the medium. So I'm going to, almost in protest of like, I don't think that slow is pretentious. I'm going to say it's like a 5 or a 6. I'm going to go a little lower.
All right.
Just to push that average down.
And on the other end, I personally found like the 3 hour Avengers Infinity War to be a total slow slog, and you know,
pretentious in its own ways, let me say.
How dare you? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, so let's talk about, we say if there was going to be a remake. It's a hard one to imagine because, I mean, who has 12 years ready to go but I don't know. I mean, it would be interesting to see the same thing done from a female perspective, as opposed to the male child perspective, and see how that would be different.
I'd love to see it in different, just people living in different parts of the world and country. Like, I just it was such a, again, you're like, will this ever happen again? Probably not. But what a joy it would be to get like a 20 movie series with like 20 different people growing up in different areas, different backgrounds and ethnicities and genders. And just to be able to get this kind of window, you just want more is what I felt. So I was like, oh yeah, I'll pitch the remake on just change any of his, any of his qualifiers and follow that kid, you know?
Yeah. Hmm. It still makes me mad that Inarritu beat Linklater for the, I mean, I'm not a Birdman fan.
Same.
but even that year was so strong for directing. What were they thinking? And you know, just think, well, I'll try again next time Richard, to try to get your Oscar. try to be more ambitious next time.
Come back in 12 years.
Yeah, another 12 years. Did any of you have a remake idea?
I had a silly one and a serious one. And the silly one connects to Conrado just mentioning the Avengers. So thanks for the good segue there. I was thinking it would be really... In Avengers Endgame, they do the time travel thing where the characters go back and jump into their old movies and like comment on them and make jokes and et cetera. And I thought it would be funny to do a version of a story like this, but make it where a time travel element is involved so that older Mason can jump back and like reflect on his life. And, you know, be like hopping around. It'd be a much more comedic take on this whole thing and kind of more of a send up of growing up movies. But I was like, I don't know why time travel popped into mind. Maybe because I'd just been sitting with this movie for a while. But I was like, what would Mason think about when he got a bottle of liquor thrown at him? You know, he never really gets a chance to talk about it in the movie. So that was my kind of silly pitch. My other pitch, though, that I only came up with today as I was getting ready was, this is so clearly a movie that is respectful of the child's point of view, I think, and how the child observes, that the children observe the world and the adults, but it's made by a middle-aged man. And I would love to see this project done again with the kid behind the camera and obviously that would have to be supported by adults. And like, as the kid grows up, they could take more creative control. But I would just love to see this like more written and directed, so to speak, from the children's point of view and let them have it'd be much looser and much more rough, and the style would probably change a lot, and maybe it would reflect more of like a home movie vibe, but to have like shepherded by adults, but have the kids lead it more creatively, I think would give a really cool, different approach to watching someone grow up like that.
Your first idea, the first thing that came to my mind, and this shows that I've been watching too many Christmas movies, is that Ghost of Christmas Past, Boyhood Edition.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Exactly, great. Exactly.
Good. What about you, Conrado? Did you think of anything for remake?
Well, I have to admit, I did not prepare for this question before coming onto the recording, and I was hoping that by the end of the discussion I would have an idea. And now I have to say that Trevor's idea of having the kid be behind the camera, that has taken over my thoughts. I think that's such a great idea, and obviously it would never happen because who would let a kid direct, unless it's like, I don't know, maybe Steven Spielberg's kid can do it, you know what I mean? Or something like that.
Someone who has complete protection from the industry by the
Yeah, exactly.
The
someone who's dead. Like I don't know, does Jeff Bezos have a kid or something? Although I don't know if I would want to watch that movie. I think that would be great. I think that's really, because I was thinking of the kind of like temporal experiment, right? And who's a director that I would want to see do something like that and have a take on something like that. And I think the answer is that what I really would love is to give the opportunity to kids from, or new directors from like different places to do it, you know? And the sad thing about it for me is that the more likely that someone has, it's such a financial proposition that the only people who can do it are people who are already rich, you know?
And
that's something. Yeah. Yeah, and that's something that I think about a lot with movies and who gets to make movies is, and what movies gets to be seen really, is who has the money to do it. You know, like it takes so much time and so much effort that it's hard to have a job and make a living and do this stuff on the side if you don't have a cushion of millions of dollars in order to like.
But then again, we're shooting movies on iPhones these days, so. There, in a way, it's more accessible than it used to be. One thing that I just thought of when you were talking is, for as close as I can think of as an example of the getting that authentic perspective is something like Minding the Gap. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Oh, I want to.
Where he's just started filming his friends when they were teenagers and interviewing them, and kept it up for years and years and then interviewing his mother and everybody, and it's such a good documentary.
I really need to see that. Thank you for reminding me of that one.
Trevor, I think you would love that movie. It's really great, and it's really touching. And I think you make a great point, Rachel. And at the same time, I feel like, in one way, making movies is easier than ever with the phones, but there's also, I feel like the gatekeeping and the movies that get attention is...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think making them is easier than ever. I think getting people to actually watch them is just as hard and is so full of complications, you know?
So that's the next thing we need to work on as a filmmaking, or rather as a movie watching society.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this has been really good. Thank you so much, Trevor, for joining us. This was a really great discussion. Let us know what you think about Boyhood over on Twitter. We would love your thoughts at Criterion Pod. And so, Conrado, how can people find you and your content?
People can find me on Twitter at CocoHitsNY, and the same is true for Instagram, also at CocoHitsNY. And if you follow me there, or in one or the other, or both, you will get updates on all the stuff that I'm doing. Rachel, before we move on, should we talk about what we're going to do next time?
Oh, right. Yeah, do you want to tell everybody what we're going to be doing?
Sure. So... The Bad Boy of Hollywood is back. That's Herman J. Mankiewicz, very famous. He is the co-writer of Citizen Kane, and there's a new movie about him on Netflix called Mank. So we are going to be looking at the original, the classic, maybe the most Criterion-y movie that ever was, Citizen Kane. And Whoa. We might talk a little bit about Mank as well. So next time we'll be talking about Orson Welles and all that good stuff. So tune in for that.
I wish you luck in tackling that behemoth of a movie.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting. Trevor, how can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at Trevor D. Wallace. And this is where I wish our movie Cram was coming out a little sooner so I could point y'all toward where to watch it. But follow me on Twitter there, and we're making a very ambitious and exciting horror movie that Conrado stars in, and if all that sounds interesting, you'll hear about it there.
Well, when it does, we definitely have you back, for sure.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So you can find me at Rachel's Reviews all over social media, iTunes, YouTube, and on Rotten Tomatoes, so check that out. And also make sure you're following the Hallmarkies podcast. We are covering all the holiday films. It's so much fun. And have interviews and other great content over there. So I would appreciate that. And thanks again, everybody. And we will talk to you all later this month on Citizen Kane. It'll be the Citizen Kane of podcasts.
Yeah, baby. Here we go.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.